I would like to show my respect and acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which these interviews take place. I would also like to respectfully acknowledge the Wangal people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which I live and work.
Over the last few years has rolled out a guideline called Everyone Can Play. And from our six principles, which were quite simple, we've actually drilled it down to three even simpler principles. And you can use this in any context, really, if you want to be completely inclusive in what you do in your work, in your social life. But the three are, can I get there, can I play, and can I stay?
I'm Prema, the host of this podcast, What Can We Do? In each episode, I speak to someone or an organization that's making impact. You will learn about the issue, why it exists, the challenges, but most importantly, how you can be a part of the solution. My hope is that you can take away 2 to 3 tips each episode that will support you in your helping journey. Today I have with me Justine Perkins, the founder of Touched by Olivia.
Oh, thank you. Good morning, everyone. I am Justine, as I was introduced. And just under 16 years ago, I founded a charity with my husband called Touched by Olivia. As the name suggests, it really set out to touch people's lives in a very meaningful way. And it is in memory of our second child, Olivia. She passed away as a little bubba. She was 8 months old. She was diagnosed with a rare disease. So she didn't have long with us, and we didn't really know that, which was pretty shocking at the time for us to comprehend. But we threw ourselves into making something meaningful out of it, and the charity came to life pretty quickly. And our main genesis was to create inclusive play spaces around Australia, recognising the right of every child to play. And it was a right that obviously Olivia didn't really get to enjoy too much. And we realised when we were in the hospital with her and just living lives as new parents that there are a lot of children out there who don't play. And so that was what our quest became.
16 years ago, when you set out to do this, what options were there in terms of inclusive play spaces?
It really wasn't a thing back then. The words all abilities were being bandied about. Ramps were becoming more of a thing in playgrounds, as were liberty swings. But they were slightly limited in what they could do, and they really only offered an experience for people in wheelchairs or those with mobility impairments. So for us, inclusive play spaces was a more holistic approach to play, tapping into sensory as well as passive and physical experiences for play. So it was, we were on the cusp. I think, you know, in a really ironic way, it was beautiful timing. And I always try and look at the positive out of what we were doing. And we really did feel that we could make a difference.
When you started this work, were there models you were referencing in other countries or across Australia? How did you know how to kind of start designing these spaces?
Do you know what? I just started as a mum, to be honest. I started because I knew what worked for me and my toddler at the time and what my mind was racing towards, had Olivia survived her disease and managed to live with it. I was living that and trying to work out what would challenge her and what would be barriers for her. And I learned a lot from talking to others and watching other children play. And then obviously we got all the experts in. We did a lot of research overseas. There are obviously other countries. The Nordic countries are very good at play. We learned a lot just by watching what they were building. And there was a little bit of research going on at the time, talking to people who were cutting edge in their landscape architect worlds, understanding different kinds of ways of playing and access, but making access more than that. It was really taking it to the next level of inclusion. So we did pull in everyone we knew who could help us on our adventure.
What was that adventure like, I guess, getting everything together and in the lead up to, I guess, the launch of that first inclusive play space?
It was manic, I've got to say. I don't know. I look back now and I don't know how we did it. I don't have the energy now to think it through, but and how it felt. But it was driven by grief and incredible tenacity to make something feel good. And I think you can't underestimate the human spirit in that respect. But I think what got me through and my husband through was our beautiful mothers group, who all bandied together. So it was really a great insight into the community and all the talents and gifts sitting amongst us to bring something together. For us, we were nobodies as far as the charity was concerned, so we had to build a profile and we had to fundraise because we had nothing. So that was tricky because a lot of it was doing events and they were the fun part too. So that brought fun back into the equation, where we were doing big balls and shouting from the treetops what we were trying to achieve. So there was a lot of angst and anxiety, but there was also a lot of fun and frivolity in bringing play to others.
Which was the first space that you launched?
Our first play space is at Five Dock. It's called Libby's Place. We pulled out our branding pretty early on to make a mark, and so Libby's Place was the first one, opened in 2009 at Five Dock.
Yeah, I've been there, and actually that's when I got to know my partner's nephew's birthday was there. And then I think it sort of kind of clicked, like, why aren't all spaces like this? I think there's incredible privilege in not having to question the kind of space you're in and whether that's accessible to you. So it's a beautiful space. What was the response like from the community when you launched Libby's Place?
Yeah, they were thrilled, absolutely thrilled. It was so well received. We knew we were on a winner when people were just in so much joy, just running through the space, and all ages. And that's the whole beauty of a play space. It's not limited just to children. And we knew that it would be loved by the community for years to come. I mean, it's almost love to death at the moment. It's about to go through another tranche of upgrades because it is so well used and frequented. But the smiles on children's and families' faces just spoke volumes to us.
I'm guessing the launch of Libby's Place would have given people kind of evidence of this space that works. So from there, how did Touched by Olivia grow?
We just continued to advocate, and councils would call us because they'd heard of this wonderful play space at Five Dock. We just sort of organically grew, and we worked with developers as well, because a lot of new developments in communities cry out for inclusive play spaces. So it became important to us to get embedded at a very early stage of new developments so that we could help guide and empower others to do the same. So, it sort of was a real spread of word of mouth and a lot of work behind the scenes by us to educate and inform others as to what an inclusive play space needed. We realized that we were sort of a collective as well, so to really succeed, we had to put some principles together, and the federal government supported us to do that with a massive workshop we held in Canberra, where we brought everyone together and we pulled together our first set of guiding principles of inclusive play. And that helped us augment what we were trying to achieve, because as you can imagine, in council world and community world, sometimes people just take it for granted that they can play, and there are a lot of communities that do provide play spaces very well, but there are many communities that don't, and they don't have the means or the, well, not the financial means even to produce something that has universal design in it. Doesn't need to cost more, but it just needs to be more organized at the start. So in our process of doing, we were also trying to educate, and that was important to really enhance it across the nation.
You mentioned guiding principles. So what are the guiding principles of inclusive play?
Well, they've continued to evolve, which is great that, you know, where we started, we built on that. And then in New South Wales, the state government actually over the last few years has rolled out a guideline called Everyone Can Play. And from our six principles, which were quite simple, we've actually drilled it down to three even simpler principles. And you can use this in any context, really, if you want to be completely inclusive in what you do in your work, in your social life. But the three are, can I get there, can I play, and can I stay? And if you can answer those in the affirmative each time, then you're pretty much including everyone. So the can I get there was all about access into the space, and that goes back from where you start your journey to get to a play space. Are there means for people, for example, on the spectrum to understand what's coming their way when they arrive? So it's having visuals available to them. It's having transport available to them, and it's just having parking or pathways. So that's a really simple thing that you can tick off very easily. Then can I play is actually, can I do what the play space is intending me to do when I'm there? And if you walk in and there's nothing for me to do, then it's not going to meet the standard of inclusion. And then can I stay talks to, can I sit down and have a little rest? Can I get some shade? Can I have some water while I'm there? Go to the toilet with dignity. So there's all those elements that you need to consider as well to roll out a whole experience of inclusive play.
Where does Australia sit now when we're looking at inclusive and universal design?
It's a good question. I don't really know. All I know is as far as play is concerned, it's really going down in the priority list. I know we could be better from an inclusive standard, and that goes from everything from schooling, I mean early childhood in play, to schooling, to education, to disability employment. I mean, there's so much scope to improve. But as far as play is concerned, Australia is going down in the stakes. For a developed country, we are quite low in our ranking of how much time our children spend playing, and that's a real concern for us. You can build everything and make it universally accessible, but if children aren't getting out to play, we've got to sort of work out why that is the case. So play's got to really start to be celebrated better. We'll still do what we do, but we've got to get everyone on board to get our kids out there playing.
Is that more of a shift in culture and technology? Or is that sort of people wanting to keep their children safe?
I think you're spot on, to be honest. I think it's very environmental, and I think there's way too much structure in our children's lives, and we've forgotten that play delivers so many benefits through imaginative and creative mindsets of just getting out there and enjoying what's around us. So, yeah, and I think there is also the fear of children being hurt or encountering some kind of risk or danger. I think that's definitely front of mind, and that's probably a digital technology shift for many of us. But I hope that things are, I think the tide is starting to turn, and through COVID we're realising that communities are generally very safe and play is really good for a child's development. So I'm hoping that, you know, we're going back on the up.
T, Today, where would you see Touch by Olivia playgrounds?
For the first sort of 10 to 15 years, we've been working around Australia. In the last little while, we've taken a bit more of a back seat because we've been just helping with the design reviews. We haven't actually been going in and doing a lot of project management of play spaces simply because, for a charity, we, in our play sense, want to become redundant. We want inclusive play to be the norm. And then our job is done when everyone starts questioning, well, that's not inclusive. Why is it done like this when it should have been done like that? So that's part of our whole mantra of redundancy in the play scope. But it's enabled us to also start expanding into other scopes of community connection through our charitable work. So it's exciting because as we feel like a chapter starting to flourish on its own, we are working in sort of a social enterprise model now for disability employment and community connections with social care. So our work will never be done, but we feel that we've got a lovely spectrum now of what we offer through Touch by Olivia to help connect communities better.
What are some of the misconceptions about the type of work you do that you perhaps face within the community or with the stakeholders you work with?
Some of the misconceptions are that the work we do is stuff that government should be doing, or it should just be happening and funded through councils, or the federal government should be doing it. And for us, our answer to that is that when we started with play, it was, well, we're doing it because it's not being done right yet. And until it's done right, we'll fill the gaps and we'll bring people along in our process so that more voices can be heard and more people are familiar with the shortcomings of what's being delivered at the moment. With our disability employment initiatives, again, it's not being done enough. So that's where we feel like we come on in and we help scale until more people see it. It's almost like a showcase. If you can see it being done and you see how easy it is to do and the benefits it delivers, then more people jump on board. And then in our community circle work, again, a lot of the work that we do there is to help support people in the community who are just needing a bit of help with their everyday. And again, there's service provider models in place that are meant to do that work, but they can only go so far. You know, there's many more hours in a person's life than their day that isn't supported if they're under a paid package, whether it be aged care or disability. So there's things that we know we can always complement and activate our community to live better lives.
I'm guessing then from the time you've launched to now, you do feel like you can slowly take a step back, that the communities and the councils are starting those conversations themselves?
Yeah. Bit of a control freak sometimes, I must admit. I'm like, that's not quite right. You are right, yes. There are certain things you just have to trust the process and evolve in a different way so that you don't always do it for them. It's like with my kids, can't keep doing everything for them. They've got to learn, and there will be mistakes, and you know, councils will get it wrong, or developers or organisations will get things wrong, but we've got to be together and learn from each other and be constructive with each other. So I think that's part of us as a charity evolving into more of an advocacy role rather than a doing. Let's put the information out there, help guide, help orchestrate change, but once we do that, let's step away and let others take the lead. And I think that's a really important part of charities being successful.
Yeah, like you said, you have to plan for a time that, in a sense, you're no longer needed, which is actually really great to hear, because I work with a lot of not-for-profits, so it's nice to hear that you are kind of planning for your eventual redundancy.
Absolutely.
In the shift from really being involved in the design and in the community and now moving to advocacy work, how is that kind of different? How have you found that you've had to change, or has your language had to change, your tools had to change?
Yeah, it's a good question. Language is a big thing, I must admit, and language is changing all the time. There's things that I've said in years gone by, months gone by, and I've been called up about them, even by my children. So you've got to stay really on the ball and really informed. And there's a lot more comms involved too, and getting it right. Just getting the message out really clearly, because there's so much noise out there and the cut through is hard. It's people are full of information and full of stuff going on, and everyone's a bit distracted by world events and national events. So it's trying to keep our message really consistent, trying to work out what works in the community, keep talking to the community, what are the social issues you're facing. And we're all hearing a lot of stuff and we can all read a lot of stuff, but it's that doing piece that's really important to get right without insulting people. You know, some people don't like to dive into real sticky social issue conversations for fear that they'll say the wrong thing. And I think we're trying to create an environment where you're better off having a go than not, and people will respect you for it, but be open to learning along the way. And that's our philosophy, that we'll only be able to support our communities if our communities tell us what they need. And it's going back to your community and being that person who listens and can construct ways and solutions that work for that person. It's that whole person-centered thinking these days that seems to be really driving change.
So it sounds like there's a lot of community listening that needs to happen, taking feedback on board. Who is in the team of Touched by Olivia, and how big is that team?
It's not very big. we have so my husband, he taps in and out. He's sort of technologically minded, so he's got ways to support our work with a particular app he's in deployment at the moment with. So that's really exciting, and he does a lot of the ministerial work, because I particularly love that, working with asking for money and trying to get funding. So that's a nice a team dynamic for husband and wife. And then we have a couple of other people in the organization. One is dedicated pretty much to doing the play stuff, so that's really cool. And another female who is doing our community circle work, and she's got a wealth of experience in social care, and is incredibly connected in aged care disability. So that's important as well, because they're the sectors that we're trying best to support. And then I'd sort of toggle between them all and try and build those connections at the grassroots level with the community, with our Livy's Cafe, which is down at our first play space. That's still going. Working with our council to expand that offering, and working with people in our community.
What is the Community Circle project?
So the Community Circles is really, it's a program, and it's the community way to help people with their everyday is sort of how we're promoting it. It's a program that has grown out of the UK and has been rolled out in a number of different countries, and we've been working very closely with the founder of that program to customise it to the Australian market. So for us, it's about filling those gaps in people's lives who just need a little bit of extra help to get them through the day. I'll give you an example. It's probably the easiest way to illustrate it is for someone who is on a package, they may get 5-10 hours a week of paid care, but there may be other things in their life that they want to do that they don't want to do with their paid carer. And they just sometimes don't know how to ask for help, or the help is a bit ad hoc, a bit inconsistent, or people want to help but they don't know how to. So we train facilitators to bring those people together. So there's a lot of people in the community who want to contribute, don't know how, and then there are people in the community who need that contribution and don't know how to bring it together. So we have best practice training that we put our facilitators through, and they go and work with someone to say, okay, what's a good day look like? What's a bad day look like? And how do we get more good days in your life? And what would you like? And what works for you? And where do you want to, when do you want to do things? Not be told when you need to do things. So it's about bringing back choice into that person's life, giving them a sense of belonging in a community. It's about taking away risk and worry. And then the app comes in as a layer to enable you to look and see, is Charlie coming around to take my dad out for a walk or take him down to the bowling club? Oh, I've seen on the app he's there. Yeah, great. He's checked it in. He's done it. And I don't need to worry about dad for his Friday night outing, or, you know, that sort of stuff is just really great tools for families and for people who are worried about others in their neighbourhood. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
And it keeps people at home longer too.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty. If people can stay in their home and not necessarily have to go to aged care facilities or into care, it keeps them better supported, and more eyes and ears on them is a really, really valuable way to enable them to live well.
What are some of the wins you're looking forward to this year?
Yeah, so we'd just love to see community circles thrive nationally and more people get involved. As far as disability employment's concerned, I'd love to see my new living room come to life, and that would be a rebuild of our social enterprise cafe, which would have the disability employment training as part of the cafe, so we would be able to offer more people the opportunity to gain experience and employment. But it would also have an activated space that's additional to just the general day-to-day cafe patrons, where we would activate different programs, and that would again be part of our advocacy arm to educate the community. So we would implement things like Chatty Tuesdays, come on down, have a chat, meet a friend. Let's talk about what's going on in your world and how do we connect you in with those organisations who can help you or help support you better. We're not pretending to be the fixer, but we would like to be sort of the enabler of connections, and that's where Touched by Olivia is moving to, is sort of creating those connections in your life to help you live better.
How can the community support Touched by Olivia and its various projects?
Oh, we always need money. Always need money. But I think what speaks more than money is sharing stories, and connect with us. If you like what we're saying, or you think you'd like to hear a bit more about community circles, you think you could do more in your world about inclusive play, or you could be a bit more of a champion for disability employment, come and chat to us. 'Cause we do work on spreading the word around and building those connections locally. We're a national organisation, but we're really, really minded to build the capability from within. And I think that's kept us really grounded and authentic, that we want the community to own these things and to be aware of what's going on around them.
Earlier you mentioned one of the misconceptions was in the work that you do, a lot of people do think the work that you do is something the government should be doing. And you rightly kind of said, well, Touched by Olivia noticed a gap and stepped in to complement it during that time. If someone is on a similar journey where they have seen a gap in community and want to step in, what advice do you have for them based on your experience?
Do it. Do it. If you've got the energy and the passion to change the way things are, then do it. I don't regret a day of what we've done. I mean, it's been hard work, but we've definitely created positive impact for many people. And don't have to do it forever. You know, do it with the mindset that in time, bring people with you to fill those gaps. But if you're the bridger of those gaps, then you're playing a really meaningful role. Find out if anyone else is doing it first. If you think there's a gap just for you, but it's not for someone else, find out why it's not for someone else and how you can get that capability in your world. I mean, there's a lot of people out there doing good stuff, and I find that, there's still a lot of silos in the not-for-profit world. So talk to people and try and be that connector before you go and do all that hard work.
Why is the work you do important?
Oh, wow. That's a profound question. Why is it important? Oh, well, can I ask you that? Why do you think the work I do is important?
I think it's, I think creating inclusion, especially in spaces that where young kids interact at such an early stage in their life, really leads to more compassionate communities down the track. And I think when you create a sense of belonging for anyone, and like you said, people tend to live in that community longer, they contribute, they can really realize their potential. And I think that's why it's important.
I think that's the perfect answer. I think for me, inclusion is the key. It's the key to so many issues that people are facing and experiencing. And I was probably like ignorant, living in a world of bliss before Olivia passed away, that life was pretty rose-coloured. So I've learnt a lot, and I've learnt to share my story. I've also lost my father in the last little while, and I've learnt a lot about what he endured because he didn't have a huge community around him. And I think by sharing really personal stories, people feel less threatened. They also feel safer to be vulnerable, and I think vulnerable is not a bad thing. And we've stigmatized so many differences in people, and to me, differences is what makes a person unique. It makes them really interesting, and everyone's got something to offer this world. And you were spot on when you said it happens at a very early age, and mindsets are set in stone really early on. And if we don't sort of continue to push that message that inclusion matters at a very early age and across all spectrums of life, then it's going to be really tricky for people. And we will learn from others simply by opening our hearts and our minds and being kind. So I think that's why the work we do is really important.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe or follow it on social media. Your support will help this podcast reach more listeners. This podcast is produced by Samuham Media.